coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody and happy Tuesday night. Hope you're all doing well. Man, I am jazzed tonight. We had a quick batter switch this evening. Hakeem, my friend, get well. I'm so sorry that he has been traveling and bebopping around the globe in the name of psi ability and psi training for the last month almost, and landed and wasn't feeling well, so he got reprieved tonight from his live appearance. But make sure to stop on by PsyGamesInternational.com, everybody. Get your tickets. I'm here to tell you this is one of the most amazing events. I do events for a living, like corporate events for a living. And this is hands down one of the coolest live events I have ever been to, much less the actual demonstrations and competitions of Psy ability. So stop on by, check that out, folks. PsyGamesInternational.com is the website that you want to go to buy your tickets for this year. They are going fast. It sold out rapidly last year. That is coming up at the Westin in Charlotte, North Carolina, July 31st through August 2nd this year. So I am going to be there. We'll be there. We'll be doing interviews. We'll be doing all kinds of stuff. We hope to see you guys there tonight. In pitch hitting fashion, as usual, our pinch hitter, Mike Turber, is on the line. As soon as Hakeem got a hold of me, I stepped out of my child's school and was like, let me see if I can get a hold of Mike Turber. Because there have been a couple of headlines in the news recently. I was actually just on the MUFON podcast with Richard Beckwith and Bob Spearing last night, talking a little bit about this stuff. But Representative Luna hit the headlines about a week ago, requesting a list of 46 videos from the Pentagon for declassification to the UFO UAP oversight committees. The deadline passed today. The deadline passed. They did not provide it. Here it is from the Daily Mail. Whoa. Sorry about that, folks. So many pop-ups there. But there it is from the Daily Mail. Pentagon accused of cover-up after failing to release UFO videos by deadline. So I was like, now we definitely got to talk about it. Mike Turber, welcome back to the show as always, my friend.
Hey, buddy. How you doing?
Doing great, dude. Doing great. Like I said, super, super jazzed about having you on tonight. As I was prepping all the stuff for pre-records, I was like, man, I wish I'd have reached out to Mike Turber. And it's just funny that these headlines happened to hit right as this happened. So I was like, this is a perfect opportunity to talk about these things while they are hot, while they are a topic of conversation, because I think that there's a few things lining up for this odd July 8th announcement for UFO UAP disclosure. Number one, why choose the anniversary of Roswell?
That's probably the best thing they could have done, because it's going to be a subject being talked about anyway. It's an anniversary. Sure, and why sure. not? So I see it from a marketing standpoint, but that date is a pretty interesting date that everyone can, that's in this community, can point back to. Yeah. And so we've come a long way, baby, since then. So there's a whole lot going on, but disclosure has not happened yet. We really are, I mean, it's really on the headlines now. It seems like it's being a major push from everywhere, from, normal academia all the way into the politicians, which we didn't have this 5-6 years ago. We weren't able to have any discussion. So, yeah, that's good that we're moving forward. So let's see where this goes and hope Trump can pull one off and we'll see what happens.
Well, that's just it. It was all of 2017 when Lou Elizondo hit the airwaves with CNN and the famed clips from Nimitz and Go Fast and Gimbel. You know, now we're talking about these. I said the other night, I said in the interview, you know, like I'm sure out of the 46 requisitioned, probably about 40 of them will be of Go Fast status, where it's like, how did they make it this far?
Yeah, exactly.
How did they make it? Like, the data is on screen. How did they make it this far?
Right. Yeah. And they have access to you know, other data that you know, sometimes we don't have access to, but we can look generally at the data that's on what we receive and pretty much figure out what things are. And so I'm thinking, you know, I'm hoping that the 46 videos, it's actually going to be over 50, just so you know, when it actually comes out. So, it's more than 46, but, when we see them, I'm hoping that they were pre-screened to a degree, because it is a problem when they say that they have the video, something comes out and it's almost like a Jeremy Corbell situation where we're all excited and then we think something's going to happen. It comes out and it's like, oh no, not another blurry video of a balloon somewhere or something like that. So I'm hoping that the quality of these, which we're being told the quality is up there, and some of them are, you know, in very high definition. So I can't wait to see it.
Well, and
keep me busy for a few.
Now, granted, you know, since we talked last, there was the there was the call by Trump for all available data on UFO UAPs to be called together and disclosed, put out.
Right.
Now, granted, folks, what that announcement means is, once again, anything publicly available, that doesn't mean that they are going to go into like top secret documents and unredact them and send them out. That's not what that means. Not one bit.
Yeah, and that is the expectation, though, because everyone is kind of expecting exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
The process for videos is different than the process for actual printed material.
Well, so let's get into that real quick.
When you look at the video, the provenance of the video has to be cared for, and then they use a form called the DD-1910 form. And if anyone remembers back when Lou Elizondo came onto the scene, what he did to get those three videos, which is the Gimbel, Tic Tac, and Go Fast, it was Clear One is the actual name of the Tic Tac video. To get those videos out, he had to reclassify or have the videos classified in a manner that allowed him to use them.
Yeah.
And there was a problem with that, but no one knew it at the time, that when he filled out those forms and sent it back, the request was essentially approved, but not for public dissemination. It was basically, it was a threat identification program that he was setting up so that there would be systems in place to identify drones and various other, whatever's in the air. And, you know, that's what the system was going to be, to quickly be able to identify these things. And what happened was, is he came out and he gave the videos to Chris Mellon, and here we are since December 16th of 2017, scratching our heads trying to figure out what's going on here. But that, you know, that date will be another date that will live in infamy when we start going down the road. So it's I don't know. I know the process they're going to go through with the videos, but there might, each video will have to it attached whatever the report is for it. So I'm curious if we're going to get both, because that should be hopefully that'll be the process, and that we get both, you know, video and whatever audio, but also whatever printed material and whatever report went along with it. And ideally, if we could get sensor data, that would be the holy grail of these 46, 52 or so videos. So it should be, it's going to be an interesting week when July 8th comes around, and it's going to be I hope they come through. I hope they come through this, because that could be released anytime.
Well, now, sensor data is where we get into part of the issue with many of these videos, Mike, because we get most of these are platform videos. They are videos from the infrared forward-looking camera, things like that. Mm-hmm. They are from a specific platform or part of a weapons platform, part of a targeting platform, things like that. It's not like they are being recorded with a standard video camera in that kind of way. It's not like we are seeing actual unstripped footage in that kind of way. We are seeing something that's definitely altered to view. And really the only sensor that's there would be either a thermal sensor, giving you a generalized surface temperature, something like that. But that's kind of part of the issue, is that we can't detect most of these things with most sensors that we have.
Yeah. And the other part of the spectrum here is that the data that's encoded inside some of these videos that come from, you know, MQ-9 Reapers and, you know, predators and things like this, that data, when they cover that data up, which they did in several cases that we've seen where we don't get the location, we don't get the speed of the aircraft that's monitoring it, or the speed of the aircraft that's actually monitoring, things like that. Yeah. So it makes it extremely difficult to try to identify what these objects are. And that's what I try to do, is identify specifically what that object was, just like the Houthi drone that, you know, when they showed that one video in Congress with the Hellfire bouncing off of that UFO.
Yeah.
In reality, you know, my analysis makes it, I don't know if you have the picture still, but because this
the
show
ninja
was thrown together pretty quick. Yeah. The that Houthi drone that was, had the ring around the bottom of it. And that ring is what we saw waddling in the wind and what have you. And I firmly believe that after looking at the location and being able to pull that data off of that screen. And that's the difference. When you have thousands of eyes looking at these videos, and of course on X, everybody goes nuts trying to, you know, say it's this.
Yeah.
But then you have trained eyes like myself and Nick West and, Florky and a bunch of these guys that are out there that we do this all the time. We can look at something fairly quickly, identify a category that it might go into, but it's extremely difficult for us to actually say that it was this specific thing on this specific day at this specific time, unless it's civilian. So if you have the military filming and civilian aircraft, yeah, sometimes we can narrow it down to the actual aircraft. But when it gets to some of the information that we don't receive, like the other sensor data or what have you, then it creates this, I don't want to use the word that's coming to mind, but it creates a storm with a vernacular in front of that, where everyone's arguing over whether or not we have enough evidence to even identify something. And in most cases, we really don't. So we just try to do the best we can.
Yeah, yeah. I've just popped the image of that Houthi drone up with the circular structure underneath it that kind of protects the warhead that it drops.
Yep.
Protects the payload, I should say, not warhead.
I sent that information off to several of the, you know, members in Congress that were part of those committees and during that hearing. And you get back some responses. Thank you. We'll take it under consideration, blah, blah, blah. And then the people that you've talked to before, they say, thank you. I've been, you know, looking for what this could be. And this is, you know, like the best answer they have to date, you know, of what it may actually be. Cause all the ticks of the questions are ticked on this thing. And it makes more sense, I guess. But, you know, that's what we're faced with when we're trying to take information that we don't have, you know, we don't have the ability to interview the people that were there. We don't have the actual, you know, raw data. Some of the data is redacted on the screen, and we do the best we can, but we try to, you know, not do a confirmation bias based on what we think it is in the beginning. But after a while, you have to start, you know, pointing towards, okay, where was this done? And it's the only object that I can think of in that area that made sense, because very rarely do you see rings hanging off of a drone except the Houthi drone, which happens to be that area. Yeah.
Well, and not only that, but also the fact that we pointed out in that video that it seemed to be the R9X version mm-hmm. of the Hellfire, which is a kinetic version, not an explosive version, which would explain why it didn't mm-hmm. blow up in proximity, because missiles don't exactly. explode on impact. They explode in proximity yep. so that you get a shotgun effect and right. guaranteed to take out your target, not maybe miss it, right. like trying to shoot a bullet out of the air.
Right, and the Hellfire missile is not normally used to shoot down aircraft of any kind. The Hellfire no. missiles are normally for ground-to-ground attack, but they have been moderately successful. But we're shooting multiple $100,000, missiles at these, $200 drones. The economics of it obviously start weighing in, and that's not going to, work. So there's a lot of solutions that are in the pipeline and have already come out that, rectify that. So you got a 10-foot long, Hellfire missile, launched at a drone that's about maybe 4 feet wide or something like that, 2.5 feet to 4 yeah. feet wide. And that's the thing, that turn that it had right at the end, was obviously interesting, but you're right. The proximity fuse, so to speak, is not a factor here. You actually have a G type fuse, which is a gravity meter or a G force meter, and it has to exceed a certain perimeter. And if it hits a light object, it's not going to go off, but yeah. it's essentially going to keep going. And that's basically what happened.
Well, and that's just it. What appears to happen in the video is that the blade from this Hellfire missile clipped that hanging basket, and the missile then mm-hmm. swung around the drone, mm-hmm. from straight inertia. But once again, it's one of those, how does it make it that far? And we even had the conversation on air with you about Lou Elizondo mm-hmm. and the pictures that he has put out, that have hit controversial points over literally the last year, where it was the chandelier and the mirror that came from a vetted source, vetted intelligence source. And then the one that was an irrigation circle that came exactly. from his vetted source in the communities. And it's like,
to get rid of that source.
at what point does intelligentsia stop vetting their sources?
Right. Yeah. And that's an issue when you have a trusted source and they give you something and you really, you're putting your own reputation on the line. In some ways, I feel sorry for Lou, but in the other spectrum, that's his job. His job is to vet the person if he's already vetted, but he has to look at the evidence. And before he goes out there and says that this object that you're looking at from this embassy, is a mothership, and he further, embellished that story by saying that he talked to the pilots who were in the air that witnessed this object. And that's when he had to really backpedal that whole story. When it was clear to anyone looking at it that has done this for a while, that object is not actually there. And we're able to determine it's a chandelier and a building, and someone shot the image through that. The question is it the person who was there taking that image and giving it to whoever his source is, that person also had an agenda, because they had to know that was not a actual craft outside, because if they walked up to the window to get a closer look, it would disappear.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've just popped that image up on screen. Where
it's an intriguing looking image. But he has to do better than that. Just like he had those two experts on the unidentified program that were saying that the GoFast was an object that was very close to the surface of the ocean and was hauling ass, was the actual term he used. And then the other pilot that they had as an expert witness said, that's about 2/3 the speed of sound. Have no clue how they got to those numbers in any way, but it ended up that the GoFast was at 13,000 feet, which I don't know about you, but is not near the ocean. And traveling at about 38 miles an hour.
Yeah, yeah. And granted, depending on the scale of the object, 38 miles an hour could be hauling ass.
Yeah, true, but not 2/3 of the sound.
However,
different for a different
it's just over school speed limit. You know,
exactly. Yeah, yeah. You got to keep that down. You got to keep the speed down in school. Huh? But yeah, and then when you looked at the apparently a pilot took a picture of that circle, which is, you know, an irrigation circle. So if anyone's driven through the farmlands of this country or any country, they have those large irrigation things. I don't know the proper term for it, but you know, they have the wheels underneath them, and under the power of the water going through them, they actually make a circle around the crop. And that's why you see all these circles when you're flying in a plane, and everybody's seen these things. You got all these circles, but that particular circle was, I guess, at an odd angle, or perhaps the angle he took it at, or the way he was looking at it, the idea of what it might be popped into his head. And when he took the picture, it just, I don't know how many times Lou's been in a plane, but he had, everyone immediately saw this. And quickly. It's not like it. I don't like using the term debunking sometimes, but we were able to quickly figure out what it is.
And I've got the image up on screen, and basically it's two of these circles near each other and close enough that, you know, I guess you could consider that one of them is in the air, the other is the shadow of that object. But if you're familiar with what these objects are and seeing them to begin with, not really. Like, I've seen them in rows of 3x3, you know, checkerboarded.
Was the pilot. Yeah, the person that took the image, supposedly, I believe, if memory serves properly, was a pilot.
Yeah.
So he should know, but I don't know. I don't know the caveat of, you know, all the nuances that happened before that was released, but that should have been under a lot of scrutiny. So hopefully he'll do better. We'll see. We'll see. He's done a lot for this. Because if it wasn't for him, you and I would not be having a conversation at all.
Well, no, absolutely. I remember when we had our first conversation about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Like, I distinctly remember it.
And that was back when I thought that the Tic Tac was a Lockheed Martin object. And what's so weird is that was 6 years ago, and you got Stephen Greer and Ross Coulthard, both of them coming out saying, "Hey, we just figured out that this is Lockheed Martin technology." I said, "No, pretty much anyone that follows me has figured out that that's not the case now after many years." But yeah. You start to wonder if we go in these cycles where we loop back to the same, dip into the same pond, and we're yanking out the same things and rehashing them again. I'm wanting to push forward and move forward, but we've got to have some sort of board or something that, has enough skeptics on one side and has enough believers, where we can balance out the issues that we have and try to move forward in a way that, gets us the answers that we actually want.
Yeah.
No one wants to believe in something that turns out to be a crop circle thing, or a chandelier, and put it on their show and out the person, because the person that's on the show is the number one guy in UFOs at the time, which is Lou Elizondo.
Yeah.
A hard pill to swallow.
Well, and a big, hard pill to swallow, yes, but it's something that, it's a pill that we need to swallow, and it's a pill that we need to accept. And it's something that we try to talk about on this show regularly, and that you've talked about with us on this show. And it's even part of what I'm talking about at MUFON this year is, why are you investigating?
Right.
Why are you, the motive, just as an investigator period, what is your motivation of investigation? Do you have a hypothesis that you are trying to experiment and prove? What is the motivation? Because if it's to prove your belief, you need to examine that, because you've got a really big filter there that you are polishing and putting all of your data through, called your belief in this topic.
Another thing going on is that there's this common misnomer out there that the people who are skeptics or debunkers or whatever you want to call them, that they're non-believers, that they don't believe aliens exist and all this other stuff. I haven't met one yet that doesn't believe that aliens do not exist, myself included. My first tattoo on my on my arm was the, you know, from the gold plaque that's on the side of Pioneer and Voyager spacecraft that leaves the solar system with the, you know, with the graphics that are on there. So that's a tattoo. I'm definitely a believer in aliens. But I just don't think they're coming here, you know, twice or three times a day to provide video footage and B-roll for third phase of the moon.
Yeah, or to leave their lights on. And I am a capital S skeptic. I will say that all the time. Mm-hmm. I wear my skeptic like Superman. I am ready to pull my shirt apart and spring into action. But I am a believer's believer, Mike, and that's why my skeptical realm is so high, because I believe so deeply. My realm of what would be considered evidence, or my realm of proof of data, must be higher than the average bear. Because, yes, I've had my experiences. I saw the amorphous black object over Houston, Texas with my friend Billy. I saw a orange light with my brother in Roswell just this last year, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I've seen my things, and they've made me question and I wonder, but it doesn't mean that I shouldn't have a critical mindset and that I shouldn't think critically.
And I think overall, over time, the advantage of having a verified story, verified by both skeptics and verified by believers, is that we actually can move forward, you know, hand in hand, so to speak, that we all are on the same path. We all want the same thing. We all want to know what's going on. We want our government to be transparent. So we all basically want the same thing. It's just we, you know, these battles that go on and forth where, you know, you're a skeptic, you're this, you're that, or whatever. It's like, it's really not that. It's just, I want to, if I'm going to believe in something, I want to make certain that I'm actually believing something that is real, tangible, or whatever. Yeah. If I spent like 30 years, you know, saying things, and then I would be devastated to find out that something was, you know, here's a case in point. GoFast is a classic example of this. Those three videos came out. I sent my, I did a thing on GoFast, and instead of posting it online, I sent it to Tom DeLonge directly. So I sent it to Tom DeLonge, Blink-182, Tom DeLonge to the SARS Academy. And then from there, apparently it went to Hal Putoff, who was looking at it, I guess, with the TTSA members, which included Lou and all those other guys. Next thing you know, Hal Putoff is doing a webinar, and my video shows up on his desktop. And so it was clear. I said, wow, that's the same name of the video that I gave to Tom DeLonge, because I don't name him normally when I save them. I just save them as project number, blah, blah, blah. But this one, I put point blank what it was. And sure enough, he had it on there. So I was like, okay, this is interesting. So at least it made it to Hal through Tom somehow. But, you know, that was like me trying, and the way that the email was to him, and said, hey, before you go too far with this one video, I wanted to make you aware of something. There's enough data in the video to determine not only the altitude, but also the speed of the craft. So a lot of these things that are being said, and this is before the TV show came out about it.
Yeah.
It was like, hey, I mean, guys, just, you know, so you don't go and, you know, have egg on your face, so to speak.
And it was well before the NASA panel, where they basically did the same thing, showed the data on screen from the camera, and were like, why are we even debating this? All the information for the trigonometry of the speed and height of this object is right here.
Yeah. And I felt so good when that came out. I was like, wow, so, you know, here's another vindication, you know, because I had a huge argument with Eric Davis, and that argument is, I guess, made it to Gaia and several other organizations, because Susan Goff, who is the spokesperson for the Department of Defense at the time, she was apparently monitoring the my emails and Eric Davis's emails of going back and forth and you know, through this, the famous email list, and it made it to Black Vault. So, you know, Greenwald, John Greenwald of Black Vault, FOIA requested any of these emails that Susan Goff may have received that included some keywords, and sure enough, that like half of the emails are my emails. So it was kind of interesting. But they redacted, you know, the names on the emails and stuff. But after a while, I was kind of hidden in corners. So, oh my God! Oh, now all my emails are going to be read by everyone in the community, but if anyone wants the unredacted version, let me know. I'll let you read exactly what was going on. but yeah, get there.
Well, and that's just it. The point here is unredaction and videos and things that have supposed mm-hmm. to been released that have not been released, right. that have been roundly refused yeah. by the Pentagon. They're like, nah, you know, we are worried about getting it to you by your deadline.
And not only that, the reasoning behind it, I get. I mean, you know, being in the intelligence community, we do run across things where we have to be extremely careful to go through something to determine whether or not it will reveal methods and tactics, or if sure. it will reveal capabilities of the equipment. And that's the thing. So that's why when we get you get a video, it looks like it's somewhat fuzzy or whatever. It's so that our adversaries cannot necessarily determine from our own releases exactly what our capabilities are. You know, how clear of an image are they getting? You know, which you know they spent $200,000 for their at flare sensor. You know, for this one pod that goes on the side of say an F-18, and yeah. And you know, China's probably spending $100 for theirs. You never know. But the quality difference and the being able to determine the capabilities of the system, that comes into play. And I get that part. But there's other ways around verifying. Just like back to the 46 videos that we're talking about. I've looked at the list. I know some of the ones that are coming out, and it's going to be a lot of people upset because most or a lot of the ones I was looking at from it's actually more than 46 videos. Just so everybody knows, it's actually because a couple of them will have two or three videos that are actually included with it.
Yep.
So it will be over 50 when it's done. But some of these things are very obvious prosaic objects or birds because you can see the wings flapping and things yep. like this. And my question is, why would that video get to this level where it is included in a list? There has to be someone like Arrow inside the government that goes through these videos, and before the government gets egg on their face, because by telling people we can't tell what these objects are, it's a little embarrassing and it makes us question our own capabilities. But we're, in the United States, we're accustomed to not trusting the government, so we don't believe what they say anyway. So it doesn't make any difference. But other countries look to us and they wonder, wow, America must have a terrible system because this object is obviously a blah, blah, blah. And to them, it would be, it's embarrassing for us to have another country look at us and say, you guys cannot figure out what's in your skies because this is obviously a blah, 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 whatever. But those few that get through the cracks that we truly question and we wonder what they really are, those are the ones I'm interested in. I want to sink my teeth into it, just like I did with Tic Tac. And so that information is being released, already released to Kevin Day reports and stuff like this. So we have that. And the other two are coming together pretty good. So, when you have the director of Arrow, when Tim Phillips came out and verified the DARPA story, that was a cool thing, verifying that DARPA and members from Air Force Research Laboratory were the ones that went onto the Nimitz ships, Princeton and Nimitz, to get those that data. That verified that those guys were telling the truth. Verified that.
Oh, so, absolutely. The issue is that you have Arrow that was just shut down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. you have Hegseth doubling down on Trump's UAP disclosure as the mm-hmm. caseload exceeded 2,000. That was right. February. That was as mm-hmm. of February. And now suddenly Arrow is no more. And right. this doubling down on the promise of let's get the files together has become a let's sweep 46 files that were requested specifically by Congress under the rug.
And that'll distract us a little bit. Hey, give them these 46 videos. Let them argue about that for a little while we distract them in a smoke and mirrors kind of thing from the other 2,000 that we don't have to talk about for a little bit. You have to wonder sometimes, especially like when you go back to the UAP task force, if we go back in time a little bit, they had 144 objects that they were to identify. and all of this stuff was going to come out, and then we had this huge hearing, and then out of the 144 objects to identify, they were able to identify, one out of the 144, and that was a partially deflated balloon. I don't know about you, but if I pay someone to do 144 tests, and they come back with one, there's a problem there. So I know they corrected a lot of those issues, and I'm happy that that's happened. But sometimes you know, it's like if you are having these problems, why don't you bring on some sort of outside counsel, outside contractors or whatever to help you with these things? Myself, Mick West, you know, sure. Dorothy, but there's a bunch of guys that are out here that's available. And do this. I've been talking to different Congress members for a long time. I have been in on conversations where they needed something identified really fast and, you know, was able to come through. And I do that behind the scenes. It helps to do that behind the scenes for a lot of reasons. But this should be something that's done more in the open, I think. I think that would keep that transparency promise alive. So,
well, hopefully we can get any kind of transparency. But you know, when once again, and we've said it, we said it on air with our good friend, rest his soul, Earl Gray, whenever he would come on mm-hmm. with us, Mike, and we would break down the Senate hearings that were happening. And I don't know if there's another one scheduled offhand. Once again, Arrow was just disbanded like a week and mm-hmm. a half ago. Numerous cases there, but as I've said before, I do not expect anything from those hearings to be the great moment of disclosure that people are expecting, where it's going to be like a Houdini moment, wheel the gurney out mm-hmm. in the floor of Congress and pull the sheet off, and here's the wreckage, and here's a hand, and you know, like, here's one of them in a jar. Like that's not what's going to happen. Go ahead.
No, that would be an incredible thing, especially having any of this evidence from that we have or any other countries brought sure. into the universities and studied that way. So you can get the peer review, which is, you know, scientific method and what have you. But we have a lot of these things that, you know, when we hear about a hearing that's coming up, a lot of people jump on the bandwagon saying that, you know, okay, this is it. This is going to be, they're going to release this and this and this. And, you know, it ends up being a huge nothing burger, which is a very, you know, terrible burger to try to chew on. It's just, you're not going to.
Absolutely.
It's a hard pill to swallow. Well, and it becomes frustrating when it happens so often. You know, I get the part where we're having these conversations and Congress is actually, you know, bringing this up and giving a lot of legitimacy to it. The other part of the spectrum is here. Remember in the beginning, a long time ago, when UFO stories were coming out, it was always individuals, you know, a guy on a farm or this thing right here.
Yeah.
And it just bounces around. And then it went up to, you know, academia, people were seeing it. And then it went into, you know, pilots were seeing these things. And then now we have military pilots that are seeing these things. And the difference now is we have a lot of Congress members that are getting into the game, so to speak. You got Burleson, you got Burchett, you've got, you know, a lot of them that start speaking about the things that they're hearing. And some of these things that they're saying are borderline open conversation of things that are classified. You know, they're not like showing us aliens or showing us this or that, which it would be great if they did, but just the mere talking about some of these subjects and giving any type of specific, it goes against the NDA that they signed and goes against the top secret security clearance protocols that are put in place, you know, years and years ago. So I'm not sure how some of this is getting by, but I'm welcoming it. I'm glad that it's happening. I feel concerned that, you know, the wool is being pulled over their eyes and subsequently ours, and I don't want to see that happen. It'd be a huge disappointment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am right there with you, Mike. And once again, I think that if anything, what we will see, hopefully, because the only way that you get capital D disclosure is through monetary means, through choking the purse strings of the black black bag projects. You take take the string on that black bag and you choke them out with it. And you stop the funding. That's the only way.
They still should have an office like an Arrow.
Oh, sure.
That does this. I mean, I don't, it's not that much money. And I think it's important enough that we have a centralized office that is structured to, because the guys on the scene may not have the equipment or the experience necessary to determine what some of these objects are, just like what we did with the Spy-1B radar information that I was able to finally figure out what that was. And that'll come out here pretty soon. Some of it's already out. But the way that happens, and the way the information is disseminated, it needs to go into some sort of structured format, just like it, that, instead of coming up with these projects like Project Blue Book, and then you bounce into, Arrow and the unidentified, task force and stuff like this.
Yeah.
Those are like throwing like band-aids on this wound of disclosure that we really need. And we need a structured thing that is a permanent in place that all, and I say this because the Air Force hasn't been so forthcoming in recent years or previous years, that that everybody works together to determine what these things are and put a system in place that helps to quickly identify them. Just like you were saying earlier, there's some that you can't see because they operate in the infrared spectrum.
Sure.
That's important. We do have, civilians that are creating organizations that are, looking up and taking notice of any objects that are moving in our sky. And a structured report system for that should be in place that they can give the information to one centralized, maybe a university or whatever organization the United States government puts up to.
That's the thing, though. And when you say don't pull the wool over my eyes and tell me something else is happening, these are pretty out in the open. Like it's not rocket math when you see it happen in real time.
We're
all about it. We're going to help out. Here's the Pentagon. We're here to help disclosure. Within a week of each other, they shut down the All Domain Anomaly Reconnaissance Office and refuse 46 videos to the Congressional Oversight Committee looking into such things. So you've gotten you're not handing data over to the people overseeing things. And then the people who were supposed to be investigating these things, who were 2,000 cases deep and didn't have enough people to deal with it, you cancel them. So how can you not be seen as obfuscating things? How can you not be seen in that light? It's pretty hard. Once again, there's no wool over the eyes. That is a straight up somebody throwing a sheep in your face is what that is.
Right.
not to see it. And even the fact of, let's get into this other topic in the last few minutes here, which is Matt Gaetz.
What?
Claiming to have heard from an Army whistleblower that alien human breeding programs exist. And
that the breeding program, they're forced to do this.
Yeah.
Which kind of bizarre. The story's bizarre. I mean, I personally have issues with it, but you have to look at the source and go, this is coming from someone who held a high office in our government. And was, and he was in his office with the other office members. It wasn't just him and some guy whispered something in his ear. This is apparently a legitimate meeting that happened between him, a Army whistleblower, talking about 6 to 12 different locations around the country where this happens. And apparently there's some forced breeding going on, and they get the people from war zones, or they get them from migrants that are trying to, to go do work or something like this,
or traffic children, that they're using to harvest adrenochrome.
Yeah, exactly. So, and when you look at this, you go, wow, that's a lot of information to reveal that you got from a whistleblower. That's not the protocol that he's supposed to follow. Granted, he's not in office now, and keep in mind, he was Trump's first pick for Attorney General.
But let's also not forget, because this comes up right after Christy Gnome's thing. All right.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that was a big thing with her husband, folks. And believe it or not, the main thing about that with her husband is the fact that it makes her a very viable asset for a foreign nation, mm-hmm, or anybody looking to blackmail a public official in such a way, and to have blackmail material over them, to have that content, to be able to get access to that content from a private OnlyFans, whatever. So when you're talking Matt Gaetz himself, like, I've got the, here is the ethics committee report from the ethics.house.gov right here on screen. The report that details how he approached underage women to pay them for sexual activities, how he used illicit drugs and these things and stuff like that.
And he's not in jail.
He's not in jail. Not whatsoever. And
it's almost like diplomatic immunity.
Just about. And it's one of the, well, it's once again amazing when you have good friends. But it's also disturbing the fact that, once again, here's somebody who, because of this and their background, would make a prime target for such things, mm-hmm, because of their access, their continued access to people,
right,
of status in the government, mm-hmm, that they would make a great asset, that they would make somebody great to be able to turn over information, yeah, or dig for information, what have you. So the fact that he is saying this,
yeah, and
is fascinating.
Something that yeah, true. And with Gaetz, you have to wonder what in the world is going on here, and why would a whistleblower go to him? Did this process start when he was still in office? Because we don't really have a timeline here that I'm aware of. I didn't see one. And if this happened while he was in office, it's a totally different situation that we would be having a very different conversation if you followed the correct protocol. But you know, we would be having a David Grush type conversation as opposed to whatever this situation is that landed in his lap. I don't know if the story is 100% accurate, then okay. But he's talking about a whistleblower that doesn't have whistleblower protection because the process, he has to follow the process, and, you know, or maybe he did follow the process. And this is a spillover leaked story from wherever it came from. It was on the Benny Show, wasn't it?
Yes.
That's the show.
It was on the Benny Show. Yeah.
So, and you know, with that being said, if this person, these people, these whistleblowers that are coming forward, their lives are changed forever, you know, and some for the good, maybe some for the bad, maybe some in the middle, and hopefully everyone goes to the good side. But you know, sometimes these people get in a little deep and they don't realize that, you know, you're going to be ultra scrutinized well beyond anything you've ever experienced before. And if you come out on the side to where you're doing talks and going around the country, more power to you. I don't have any problem with anyone doing that or making money from doing that. But if it's, you know, the issue is that it does change them. And, I don't know. It's a weird thing that the whistleblower protection is done in such a way, but the person releasing the information is a former congressman, and your mind has to question, especially with his background.
Yeah.
Why go? I mean, it's a huge question mark over the top of his head right now.
The exact claim here, let's be clear. The alleged program involved captured extraterrestrials mating with abducted humans from war zones and migrant caravans to create hybrids for intergalactic communication.
Yeah. So some of the questions that you'd have to ask is, okay, why are they being pulled from war zones and from migrant, you know, workers moving back and forth or whatever?
Because they won't be missed. Because they won't be missed.
Exactly. So if you're an alien and you come to this planet,
smart aliens,
smart aliens, they would know. Or you ask the government that's working with you, and the government says, hey, I tell you what, here's how you do this. If you take these people from war zones, or if you take them from migrants that are moving back and forth across borders. If their disappearance won't be noticed that much.
Yeah. And that is supposedly part of the so-called Eisenhower Accords, you know, Dwight D. Eisenhower famously met with them, and it was agreed that they could take a certain number of people every year for programs and things like that. However, this program is not run by aliens.
No.
The whistleblower briefed him on a secret alien human hybrid breeding program.
Right.
Involving captured extraterrestrials mating with abducted humans from war zones. So it's not like they're splicing them together, Mike.
No. They're getting them copulated. I mean, this is what it sounds like. The other thing is it was forced. And when I read it, I had to go back and reread the transcript from it and then listen to the video or the audio from the video to make certain I heard this properly. It sounded like they were saying that the aliens were the ones that were forced to do something, not
necessarily they're captured. They're captured aliens.
Okay, what's going on here? This is way more bizarre. Because if on the surface, if you just hear the story, you'll think that, okay, the people being forced to do it are the people here, you know, the humans. But when I went back, I said, wait, I think I read that wrong. Let me read this again. And it was the aliens are the ones being forced. That just threw this into such a bizarre category that I don't know. I'm going to have to wait this one out and see where we're going to go with this. I'm not going to put too many resources on it, but I do want to see where it goes.
That's a very measured way to say that. I'm not going to put too many resources on it. I'm lifting that. Not going to put too many resources. That's like the one that I heard from JobSite, my last show in Atlanta, where you're asking great questions.
Exactly. My one man band operation here. I'm not sure what amount of resources I put on this.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But in sincerity, it's something that when you look at things in a forest and the trees situation, and I am no conspiracy theorist, folks. Worked with one for a little while, but I ain't one. Okay. I see patterns. I see these things happening. I see it like literally unfolding where it's like, hey, we're going to demand all this stuff happen with UFO files. And then the military is like, the people in charge of the military are like, absolutely, we're behind you. We're going to make this happen. It's important for national security, and the people have a right to know. And then the people who are in charge of the oversight committee are like, absolutely, I'm glad you're behind it. Here's the list of the ones that we've heard about that we'd like to see. And they're like, well, you know, I don't know about that. By the way, you guys over here that are crazy backlogged investigating this shiz, you're out. You're out.
Yeah, exactly. That
you got
made no sense.
You
at
got
all.
DEI. Yeah, you're out.
Yeah. We're gonna get rid of the resources that we need to actually, you know, properly go over these videos with ultra scrutiny to figure out what these things are. It's just very confusing as to why some of these decisions are being made when really that program doesn't really cost that much. Like, granted, they get a lot of cases, but they may be backlogged for a while, but they'll catch up.
It's not confusing at all to me, Mike. That is how you run a dialogue. That is how you build a dialogue. That is how you build the story in the facade that you want it to be.
Yeah.
That's how you control a dialogue.
You build it, and then you try to destroy it to see after someone has it.
Yep.
It's just like an addiction. And, you know, after you have it for a while, we're going to take it away from you. We want to see what kind of response is this. Was this really a program that everybody really wanted? Yeah, that kind of thing. I can see that being, you know, measuring the response of in the reaction to them disbanding, you know, this program.
Absolutely.
But hopefully Trump will come through with, you know, with the disclosure as promised.
I hope so. I hope so.
I do too. And, I mean, he did it with that Iranian missile.
Here's the thing. And that's just it, folks. This is something that I remind people about on air and off air. And, you know, Mike, we don't do a lot of politics here. The color of the show is purple, partially because of politics, because that's where we should all be. Yeah. We should all try to be in the middle, even whenever we're judging data for the paranormal, things like that. We should be in the middle. We should not be polarized and charged one way or the other. We should be as neutral as possible. So
I'm registered independent.
the idea that Trump has any kind of control over that.
Yeah.
You know,
that's another issue too.
He can resolve it from the absolute desk with a presidential order. He can do all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean it's going to happen. It doesn't mean that feet won't drag. It doesn't mean that big blocks of black won't be all over the pretty white pages. It doesn't mean that anything that is top secret will be unsecretified.
Right.
Not one bit.
There's things the president doesn't know about. You know, there's a need to know.
Yeah.
Laws with all these classifications and things. And I keep hearing the term, though, these are above top secret. They're above the president. No, they're not. There is no such thing as above top secret. There are many different varied categories of
top secret.
Compartment or top secret. Yeah, you got top, you know, your top secret FBI. So, you know, you have your compartmentalized information, and then they may have an internal name that they apply to, like Umbra or Next or, you know, all these different names that you can put behind them. And the president can specifically state that this is going to be declassified right now on the spot. They can do that. And that gets a little scary sometimes, but so far that program has not been abused that I've seen. I mean, even when he put out that super close up image of that Iranian missile that time, which revealed, you know, that our optics from, you know, low Earth orbit or to medium Earth orbit are a lot better than people thought, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, that was a long time ago. And that image is the one thing that made me excited that Trump would actually do it, where if he revealed that image and it was not fuzzed out. I mean, it was clear as day. And so, wow, look at that. That's just like the images I used to look at. And it's there it is right in front of me. I'm like, okay, that's interesting. So hopefully we'll get some more of that. That would be a cool thing.
Well, and I hope so. You know, once again, it's one of those, I look at it as data. I don't care if it is testimony, if it is photographic, audio, video, sensory, doesn't matter. It's all data that adds to the data set. So let's get it. I want it. Mm-hmm. I want to see it. And once again, I don't think we're going to end up with the disclosure that the community wants. Even the fact of most of the community, whenever they watch them, are like, oh, we already know this. So it's like, yes, you do. It's not for you. You are a minority of the public, folks. Those of us who are educated are the minority of the public. They are there on behalf of the majority of the public who don't know jack about it. Like, there's 70% of the public that has, like, I've heard the term. I don't know, though.
Yeah. Yeah. If you ask 100 people what UAP stands for, they, you know, 90 probably would not get it.
Yeah.
But they all know what UFO stands for.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an interesting time. I do hope that some of the information, especially the information that's being talked about by various representatives, you know, in Congress and the Senate and so forth, that they don't get themselves in trouble. One, because some of the things they've already said make me question, like, wow, okay, what he just said would normally mean he's going to be called into a meeting and be told that, hey, you may be a senator, but you can't give this information out when it's given to you in a classified environment, like in a SCIF or just the information itself is classified.
Yeah.
They're talking about things that I know if I had talked about it, I would have been out, you know, kicked down on my butt there.
Yeah, but, hey, you can't talk about the captured aliens.
Yeah, exactly.
Not about the captured ones. Talk about the dead ones.
Yeah.
Talk about the dead ones in the tubes, but not the captured ones that were breeding with people.
Yeah. And, you know, again, like I said earlier, you come in there to the hearing with a big jar and have one sitting in the jar.
Yeah.
That would be
just
awesome. And,
Independence Day, just this huge tube filled with goo. Whap! Yep. There they are!
That's it. That's what they are. And they're like, probably already here. We'll find out later the octopuses or octopi or whatever the actual term is. Yeah, they've been here all along.
but that's just it. To think that I think is a little much and more than ridiculous. What hearings in Congress are for is to lay a legal means by which to expose something and put a stop to it. No different than, you know, the Iran-Contra affair, where eventually we had Ollie North who stood up and said, yep. On behalf of this alphabet agency who's been lying and these other people, I help sell things and move things around.
Yeah.
You know, and
he's a government paid drug dealer.
Yeah. And at best case scenario, that's what we will get is a UAP Ollie North equivalent from an alphabet agency or contractor thereof. That's like, you followed the money to the door and I was the one that had the key to the door.
Yeah. And I thought he was going to be a patsy there for a moment. But, you know, I guess kind of he was, but not to the degree that some of those things are carried out.
And so now he's a commentator. Now he's a talking head and revered.
He goes to show you that we can have people do some things that obviously are not things you want to be known about, but apparently they thrive in those communities. I mean, so I don't want to mention any names.
Nope.
But there's quite a few in our community.
Well, Mike, man, as always, I want to thank you for coming on, hopping on, going through this with us, because it's a lot. There's a lot to break down inside of this stuff. It happens. It hits the headlines for like part of the day, and then, you know, like an authorized Chinese ship going through the Strait of Hormuz just overshadows it all. It's interesting to see the tidbits that come out when you see them.
Right.
And it's interesting to try and put the mirror back together and try and get some semblance of the light that it can reflect. So thank you for always being there for that. Thank you for always coming on, especially in such short notice. You're always right there, man, whenever I call. So thank you. Thank you as always. Let everybody know where they can go to follow your work, where they can go to keep up with 5x5 News and everything that is Mike Turber.
Probably the best place to catch the current information and to be able to interact is probably going to be on X. Some of the lives that we're going to start producing here over the next month will come on to TikTok and also on YouTube, and we'll do some spaces on X, because once I start releasing some of the Nimitz information, which some of it's already out and making a little stir in the community there, that's going to be important for someone to explain exactly what it is we're looking at here. So and visualizations and things like that. So X will be your primary spot to get current up to date, because then within a minute I can do something, and then on TikTok it'll be that's the direction we're going to go. For TikTok is going to be the lives, and then back to spaces on X, and then the YouTube live. So the YouTube, TikTok, and X.
Absolutely. And hold the line real quick while we close out with the audience for this segment. Thank you so much once again, Mike, as always, for everything that you do. While you are online. Thanks, bud. While you're online checking out everything that is Mike Turber, folks, by the way, right there on curiousrealm.com/videos, you can find all of the embedded YouTube channels of our guests, including Mike Turber and 5x5 News, which is right here underneath our UFO, UAP, and declassified government panels, which had all the Artemis stuff on it. So stop on by, check that out, folks. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by Brad Olson. We will be talking about his new book about the secret of secrets of Antarctica, everything from the new Schwabenland base down there with the Nazis to, you know, great pyramids being down there, former civilizations, possible actual civilizations right now. Will we find out about that? We'll find out from Brad Olson right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying through that with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used, combusted, reused until nothing remains. And I mean every part. Seeds, stems, fibers, roots, buds, leaves. Every part follows that unique process until nothing remains but an amazing spigeric product complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by. Check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more, as well as get a free edible on your way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing author, researcher, and world traveler, Brad Olson. He is the author of the all-new book, Secrets of Antarctica, Untold History of the Ice Continent. That is available at cccpublishing.com. I am about 100, 150 pages into this book, Brad, and the data that you have laid out, the things that you have put down are absolutely awesome. Welcome back to the show, by the way. How are you this evening?
Hey there, Chris. Thanks for having me back on the Curious Realms. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and glad you've delved into the book and see some of the secrets of Antarctica that I reveal in the new title.
Well, and you know, you are one of the few people that I know who has been, I only know actually one other person who has been to Antarctica. And they were a researcher who a friend of mine introduced me to years ago. But you were one of the only people I know that has been to all seven continents in that kind of way. But as opposed to that, you actually mounted your own research trip to Antarctica, unlike most people who are going there for work, that kind of stuff, scientific research in that realm. You went on your own volition and on your own dime to do this expedition. So let's start diving into that a little bit. What was that experience like for you just to even chart that mission to begin with?
Yeah, it was no small task to get to Antarctica. I'll tell you, Chris, it by far the hardest trip I've ever taken, but you could say also the most worthwhile because so very few people get to go down there. And as far as I know, I'm the only researcher in this field that has self-financed and gone down there looking into the big questions. And that is every research station I went to, even the Ushuaia Yacht Club, asking the same questions. Do you know anything about these three massive craft that are in the ice, which have been known and nicknamed Nina Pinta and Santa Maria by the NSA since the 1970s. But nobody that I talked to seemed to know anything about it. I also asked about antediluvian civilizations, giants under the ice, or pyramids poking through. And again, kind of hit a brick wall with that line of questioning too. But I did find that a lot of the people that worked at the bases, at least the ones that spoke to me, did know that there were no fly zones, places you cannot go, no go zones. And on one case, there was a sighting of UFOs at a sister Argentinian base only a few weeks prior. So I got a secondhand UFO report. Maybe it's gone to MUFON to investigate. I'm not sure, but they told me that that was all the banter with the UFO sighting on the base and talking to their other comrades at the other bases just before we arrived at the Brown base.
Wow.
On the peninsula.
Wow, that is remarkable. And once again, just the idea of being able to go down there to begin with must have been overwhelming to comprehend, much less to be able to talk to researchers that had been at these locations, that had done these things. Let's start peeling back a little bit. You started off with the Nina Pinta and Santa Maria, the three craft that are supposedly under the ice sheet there that the NSA knows about. Let's uncover that story a little bit real quick, Brad, and how that came to be in the book and what you've uncovered there.
Sure, yeah, and this is really my fascination because I believe that we're going to get meaningful disclosure out of Antarctica. In fact, on the back of the book, I say, all roads lead to Antarctica. Of course, no roads lead to Antarctica, but it could very well be the location that provides meaningful evidence that there was some UFO ET related artifacts that have been left down there, perhaps for thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. So in my book, I've been able to locate some of them, including the one in New Schwabenland, the German held territory at the beginning of World War II. And this is on the throwback machine. All of them, I try to give the GPS coordinates so people can do and research it themselves. So if you go in the Wayback Machine on Google Earth,
yep,
in year 2013, and go to the German Konin base, K-O-H-N-E-N, this is what you're going to find. Some kind of massive machine that they're doing a they're digging it out. Here's another image of what it looked like in 2013 with a runway, with snowmobile tracks, with
wow,
yeah, with in a blow up of the actual digging into the craft, and this is where pretty sure this is the location that Emery Smith says there is a door that you can go into and enter into the craft. Of course, it's very far away. It's hard to get to. You need permission to go there. I'd like to go if I ever went back to Antarctica with a film crew. I think that would be a wonderful opportunity. And then I've been able to locate, I think, one of the other two, and that is from the whistleblower Spartan One, who interviewed with Linda Moulton Howe, and this is on the Beardmore Glacier, this giant craft partially sticking through the ice. And he gives a description of going in there and finding these hieroglyphs on the wall, including this big one of the Black Sun, which was an occultic
Yep.
Symbol of the Annenerbe Society and the Third Reich. So just taken together, Chris, I think this is pretty good evidence, including some other smaller ones. Maybe this isn't Nina Pinta Santa Maria, but it's a something dish shape sticking out of the ice. And maybe it's what we're looking for. That is some kind of extraterrestrial artifact on the ice.
Well, and, you know, especially when you're talking about that, there are reports regularly. There was one that came out not too long ago about an entire rainforest being found under the ice. Like, we forget the fact that, A, we as humanity are very, very young, Brad.
Yeah.
Like, just to give you all a glimpse, folks, like, America turns 250 this year. That's how young we are, just as a country to begin with, much less as a humanity. You know, like 10, 30,000 years is a drop in the bucket to time and to other civilizations that have been around. So when you start looking at what may have been here pre-ice sheet, what could have lived in that primordial jungle, you know, things like that. Yeah, you may be looking at antediluvian civilizations. You may be looking at remnants of giants, things like that.
Absolutely. And that's why you could have a very meaningful disclosure coming out of Antarctica in the coming years, because there are so many different locations and different presumptions of what is down there, including what's under the ice, as you said, a whole different environment. And so, you know how last year they were doing the scans on the Giza Plateau, Philippe Bondé and his crew were doing those scans? Just in the same way that we have a new, greater understanding of what's below the Giza Plateau, they're doing the same kind of scans in Antarctica. And some of the results that are coming back are equally impressive, showing literally new environments down there that have never been seen before. Yeah, this one's on the surface, but again, you see the roads and the snowmobile tracks of this two pyramid shapes. And it should be mentioned that Mother Nature does not create perfect right angles like that.
Not on that scale. No, like it will on a scale like this, you know, where it's like, here's a tiny little cube of mineral, but not on the scale of that.
No, exactly.
Not on the scale of that. So, and even whenever you look at what's here on screen, folks, just to describe it to the listeners, you're looking at two very large structures with inner walls, not just an outer wall, but inner walls, but what looks like roadways inside of them. Like this is a large, large complex that is being shown on this image.
Yeah. And especially because you can see the roads that go through it and around it. So clearly you've got some kind of archaeological discovery being made, but they're not coming forward with it. This is not what, is taking the headlines right now. And I wish it were, because you can see the stairs going up the middle. You can see the right angle. As you mentioned, the outer wall, it appears. So these are just incredible places in Antarctica that definitely deserve a lot more look than they're given credit for.
Now, in your previous research, things like that, have you found anything that points to Antarctica from other civilizations, things like that?
Well, you've always heard the term Atlantis, the lost continent, and other civilizations. And some of these scans that they're doing below the ice, and some are even poking through the ice, which show almost perfectly symmetrical city blocks, which, again, Mother Nature does not create in these perfect right angles. And you've got from some of these scans what looks like, pyramids poking through the ice as well, and entire cityscapes. And some of those are starting to get some more headlines in some of the UK newspapers. I've got some clips here of some headlines saying they're finding cities below the ice and all kind of symmetrical city-like plans. And that can only be done when fashioned with intelligent hands. Even NASA is revealing, reveals traces of ancient human settlement underneath 2.3 kilometers of ice. So,
wow.
To me, this is just a game changer. This is showing that there had been an advanced civilization on the Earth a long time ago, because this ice takes a long time to accumulate to that degree to cover it with 2 miles of ice.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And to be literally the largest repository of fresh water on Earth. You know, there is so much ice. But at the same token, with all that, it's not necessarily like the Sahara, things like that, where you're going to deal with erosion in that kind of way. You may deal with some wind erosion, that kind of stuff, but there's almost no moisture that falls on Antarctica on an annual basis.
That's right. In fact, it's classified as a desert. And there are some areas in this dry valley region, not too far away from McMurdo, where it has not rained or snowed for millions of years. It is literally the driest location on the planet. And that's where they even practice the lunar and Mars rover, because it's such a cold, inhospitable, but dry environment, which mimics those two locations.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And, you know, these things, once again, there have been stories in the past that have come up about this stuff. Like the example that I give is the people of Hawaii talk about going down to where the icebergs are and stuff like that, that they sailed as far as that. We know they made it to Rapa Nui.
Right.
You know, which is literally close to Antarctica, you know? So it's one of those, the odds of other civilizations making it there. What stories do we have of that, Brad? Before we get into, well, New Schwabenland and the Nazis going there.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Hawaii and Easter Island, because those are two of the corners of what was the continent of Mu, also known as Lemuria, which were predating Atlantis. So another civilization. And I have some references in the book of possible Lemurian civilization or influence in some of these ancient civilizations. I don't remember the Zuni elder named Clifford Mahudi.
Yes.
He spoke at several conferences. Yeah, he was a good friend of mine. We would always meet up every time I went down to Sedona. Fortunately, he passed a couple of years ago. But he made a very strong case that the ancestral Puebloan people, which are the Hopi and the Zuni, and some of the other older Native Americans in the Southwest, were all descendants of Lemuria. Mm. That there was, just in the same way that Atlantis survivors spread to Europe and the Atlas Mountains of Africa, according to Edgar Cayce, Clifford Mahudi said that these populations, including those in South America, some of the high cultures there, were the survivors from the sinking of the continent of Mu or Lemuria. And then here's a map from the Chinese who were charting out the world in 1421. That's just incredible. Over 70 years before Columbus. And they already have a pretty accurate version of the world map.
Yeah.
Including Antarctica.
Yeah, precisely. When you start getting into that, when you start breaking apart the fact that this is a land that has been there, that's been talked about There had to have been something that came from there. There had to have been some kind of stories about it in some sort of cultural aspect.
Yeah, exactly. And the Chinese were prolific explorers, as evident with that map. And it was interesting that they depict that little island, which is not there anymore, but that's approximately where the continent of Mu was. Yeah, right there. So they might have had some pre-knowledge of that continent existing and sinking into the Pacific too, and that made it onto their map.
And let's get into Mu real quick, the civilization, and at least according to legend, what happened to Mu?
So there was a British colonel, his last name was Churchwood, who was assigned to India in the 19th century. And Churchwood became friends with some of the rishis, which is a word for the seers, the holy men of India. And he was given access to some record books of this lost continent of Mu. And he went on and wrote books and published quite a bit of material about it. He's the main leading researcher who popularized the whole notion of this continent that sank in the Pacific before Atlantis did, and might have even been involved in some wars with Atlantis.
Yep.
Because in some locations you find vitrified stone or glass explosion marks, say in the Sahara Desert and up in present-day Pakistan. And he was saying that there was a war.
Yeah.
We might be leading to. And it would be these two powers that were fighting with very high-tech weapons. And so that may or may not have led to the sinking of both of those continents. It was more likely just a pole shift, which happens somewhat regularly on Earth. I say regularly, but it's about 16 to 20,000 years. But in geographical and geological time, that's not very long at all.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, we are well overdue right now for the full polar shift in that way. Right. And it's interesting that whenever you follow the North Pole, like it's been on the move almost a mile a day since 2012. Like if you ever wonder why you wake up one day and your GPS shows you across the street, you know, things like that, where it's like, how am I across the street suddenly when I woke up in my own house? That's why. Like it's been a moving target for GPS and wreaking havoc for almost a decade.
As well as in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yep.
So the geographic South Pole, it remains where if you're spinning atop at the very bottom of the world, but the magnetic South Pole is already off the continent.
Yeah.
So if you were sailing a ship in Oates Land, which is basically directly below New Zealand, your compass would point out to sea. It would not point towards the South Pole because it's already moved that far off the continent.
Yeah. And, you know, all these things, whenever you take them into consideration, whenever you start thinking about, A, how long that continent has been under a sheet of ice, how long ago? Because, like, they're pulling out cores from a million years ago sometimes.
Right.
And yet still there are things like this. There are stories about it. There are legends about it. There are various cultures that have talked about coming from the area, or even going to the area, once again, like the Hawaiian people. So it's been known for a very, very long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then as evident with these old texts that Churchwood used to write his books about the lost continent of Mu, which we should say is even closer to Antarctica in its present location than Atlantis was. Mm. So there's pretty good evidence that those old civilizations that can be detected by scanning under the ice could very well be from an earlier civilization than Atlantis. But Dr. Michael Sala has given me GPS coordinates for some locations where you can see, again, that grid work, perfect symmetry of a laid out city. And his understanding was that was Atlantis. And that's along the western portion of Antarctica. It's also called the Antarctica Peninsula or the Palmer Peninsula. And that's the area that I went to. And this is a picture of it in its entirety. And that's where I went sailing. That's the portion of Antarctica that I went to, right up in those islands. And he gave me some GPS coordinates kind of down here.
Okay.
That, and it's in the book of what looks like, again, a city grid. And his understanding was this was Atlantis, because that portion of Western Antarctica came down the mid-Atlantic ridge to its present location after the last pole shift. So Antarctica is actually two continental land masses that could conjoin in its current location, whereas Eastern Antarctica broke off from Pangaea, a Gondwana land, which included Australia, Madagascar, India, and Africa. They were all conjoined at one point. Yep. And I can say this with certainty because they're in the fossil records. There are plants and animals that only match those certain areas and could not have swam across the vast expanses of ocean to get to their present location. They had to be joined at one time.
Well, and when you're talking about an entire civilization disappearing, like especially Atlantis, Mu, things like that. Once again, the idea that human history has been rewritten, we forget things rapidly. Brad, just as a humanity, we forget things. Like even right now with Artemis II, one of the big things I have seen people asking is, you know, like if we landed on the moon 50 years ago, why aren't we just landing on it again? And it's like, that's like saying your grandpa built cars 50 years ago. You have no idea. I haven't built a car in 50 years. We're just going to go off a few things grandpa told us, build a car and just put it on the road, start selling them. You know, no, there are things that we have to relearn. Like we have to make sure that, like, right now, what they're basically practicing is that get home maneuver, that emergency maneuver that's so famous from Apollo 13. You know, that if you can't do that, you're going to have real problems. If something happens while you're up there, this is at least your emergency return path. You have to practice that before you ever land, you know, because even if there's a problem coming home, you got to have a plan, you know. Yeah. So and that's just it. There are things that we forget as humanity, even as recent as that. When it comes to technology, there are things that we have reinvented numerous times. So the idea that we have lost technology or lost civilization on Antarctica and possibly refound it, that brings us right into the Nazi world now. and the idea of not just building bases there, but recovering bases and technology that's there.
Yeah. And of course, there's a whole chapter on this in the book, because there's so much information on that. And that's a good point, because I've discovered several different data points saying that the Nazis had been given the coordinates of a defunct ET base that they could just take over and make their own. And it's very interesting because they were doing these expeditions to Tibet all throughout the 1930s. And remember that movie, 7 Years in Tibet?
Yes.
With Brad Pitt. So he's supposedly playing not just a mountaineer, but an archaeologist who went down there, and he was he came back with an incredible wealth of information and documents in 1938, and the Germans wasted no time in mounting their first very publicized expedition after Ernst Schaefer was his name, came back with this incredible cache of ancient Tibetan documents. And it's also presumed that Ernst Schaefer and his exploration team made it into inner Earth, or perhaps a cave system in Tibet, where they got some of this information, but were also told how the Germans could then use their submarines to penetrate deep underneath the ice. Because already in World War II, they had created these maps, which I reprint in the book, which are just absolutely amazing, how the U-boats would go under the ice. And you know how Germans are. They're very exact. They say, you dive 52.6 meters. Yeah. That's exactly what they mean. But then here in the written instructions in German, you can clearly see here, of course, we decipher it, but you can see that it is to Agartha. They use that location by name and heading in there. So these are some of the New Schwabenland Nazis that set up base 211. And with knowledge from the Tibet excursions of Ernst Schaefer. So it ties in the whole world then into going into these inner Earth realms. And then you also have quite a bit of evidence that the Germans were also tied to aliens and perhaps some of the not so good ones. This was from the MUFON Symposium.
Mm-hmm.
You may recognize that slide of all the different Honeyboo and Vril craft. This really took me by surprise to see how many variations and versions, not only discs, but of flying orbs. So remember, in World War II, the Allied planes were being harassed by these orbs that they called Foo Fighters. And here they are in this graph of different flying objects created by the Germans.
And this recovered technology, specifically because the Germans, Hitler specifically, and Goebbels and a few people were highly into not only esoteria, but into dark arts, black arts.
Yeah.
The idea of, yes, the black sun. They adopted numerous symbols, including the black sun, but also, of course, the swastika. Things like that from Eastern teachings. Just like you're saying, they acquired these maps. They acquired this knowledge, everything else from India.
Yeah, and I went to India when I was backpacking around the world in 1993, and I was just amazed how many times I would see the swastika symbol. And I'm thinking, what the heck? You know, what came first? Well, clearly, the swastika came from ancient India, and it's a religious symbol. It symbolizes reincarnation, but it's also an image of the Big Dipper replicated four times. And if you put it head over heels on it, I do have a image of it in the book I'm trying to flip to. It is the swastika. It's quite amazing that that there are images from the universe, from our solar system that can be seen that were worked into some of the imagery of the Third Reich, including the swastika itself.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, once again, that is the procession of the Big Dipper throughout the year. That brings that up, and there's an image of that right there, folks. And how
there
that
it is, you found
that,
it.
How that is expressed in that kind of way. So, and yeah, you know, we are intimately, we are no longer as our, not even our ancestors, our great, there you go, our,
this is my book, yeah, the Big Dipper, four times.
Yeah, like, and we say it on the show regularly, Brad, our generation specifically is very disconnected from the stars. I'm 50. I know you're slightly older than me, but like my grandfather knew by certain constellations in the sky when deer hunting season was, things like that. Like, they had a different connection to the world than we did because of these things. And the lifting of that esoteric knowledge, the use of that esoteric knowledge, especially in occulted ways, like the Nazis usurped, they usurped it and usurped it very, very well, and used it to their own ends and used it to their own magical ends in that kind of way, empowering it and imbuing that symbol with something that was antithesis, to the point that it even changed the way that the world viewed that symbol, you know?
Good point. And you can see how important such signs from the stars would be to ancient people.
Yeah.
When they should plant their seeds, when they should harvest. And this is all in the science called archaeoastronomy.
Yeah.
And I was quite amazed. All of the very ancient sites you go to, from the medicine wheels of Canada and the Midwest and the West on the Rocky Mountains, to Machu Picchu, to many of the stone chambers in Europe, they're all pointing to significant dates, such as the solstice or the equinox, but also they're charting out the movement of the stars. And the reason is their calendars. It's archaeoastronomy. So it's using the archaeology and then figuring out what astronomical alignments they're pointing to, as well as the sun rising and falling. Because of course you can tell when the days are longer, that it's coming on to summer. And then after the summer solstice, days get shorter and would be time to harvest the crops. So when you find these things in the ancient sites, you realize that our forefathers were pretty darn intelligent. Like you said, even your grandfather using signs in the stars to find out when the best hunting season is. People were a lot more attuned to seasons and the movement of the celestial bodies than they are today.
Well, and that's just it. You know, and that in and of itself is a form of technology, Brad. The idea that you are using something external from yourself to make your job of harvesting food, be it putting it into the ground or taking it out of the ground or shooting it off the ground or out of a tree, to
make
that
easier. Now there's an app for that.
That's right. There's an app for all of that. And you know, I make the example all the time of, you know, a thumb drive. Like, there's one right here. This is a terabyte.
Wow.
Just in my lifetime, to think about a terabyte of data.
So much data.
And the fact that this has schematics on it, this has things like how to build computers, all kinds of things. You take this, you throw it over your shoulder. Who knows what it is 1,000 years from now when it's found?
Back in time, right? With some kind of device where they can read off of it.
Exactly.
Change the course of humanity.
Exactly. And it's the idea that, like, there are schematics on how to build a computer on there, all kinds of things, you know, that could help rebuild humanity as far as we know. But if you don't know how to access the technology, if you don't know what the item is, if you don't know how to read it, I hold in my hand every episode a crystal while I talk. And it's said for the longest time that, you know, Atlantis used crystals to store data, all kinds of things. And people have said for years, like, oh, that's foolishness. That's crazy. It's been said that was fully what the crystal skull was capable of doing, was storing data. That was found out by GE long, long ago. And in addition to that, we now are talking about Superman crystals that science has made, small wafers of quartz that can literally hold hundreds and hundreds of terabytes of data for eternity, because they don't degrade. Unless you have something that's going to melt that quartz, that data will stay on there forever, as opposed to that thumb drive I threw over my shoulder, which, given certain circumstances with magnets and whatnot, could blank that out, you know? So the idea of ancient civilizations being able to save data on quartz, or even, you know, esoterically plant that data into the crystal, I don't put it past us as humanity one bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And Edgar Cayce said the reason for the anomalies in the Bermuda Triangle is because there is a sunken Atlantean fire crystal that's still active and firing energy and creating these wormholes or gaps in time and space. So don't ever underestimate the power of crystals. There's so much more to them than we can see.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, when you're talking about, once again, ancient civilizations, people, there was a different connection to things, I think, because of the time that things took. Even whenever you're talking about a building project, something along the scope of the Great Pyramid, you know, things like that. I think that there is a different consideration about the construction of such a thing, because it takes generations to build such a complex, to build such a place for its purpose-built purpose. And the real question comes to bear that by the time it's finished, do you even remember why you started building it in that kind of way? Like, has the function of that space possibly even changed and evolved before you've even finished constructing it, because of the multi-generational concept of building it to begin with?
And then when it's built, it might last in existence under the ocean or under the ice in Antarctica. And that's what we see today.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, what do you think, especially as the ice thaws, as science is getting there more, as it's becoming more readily available to us as far as our technology for exploring the space, things like that. What do you see in the next few years, Brad? What do you see as far as any kind of announcement? We have July 8th coming up, supposedly. We'll see. I find it funny that it's happening on the same exact day that the first announcement of a disc being shot down by the Air Force at Roswell was announced. But what do you make for disclosure on that front? And how do you think things will tie in with Antarctica over the next few years?
So the season for all the scientists going down there is November until early March. So right now, everybody's clearing out of there or already gone. There's only 1,000 people on the entire continent, which is the fifth largest continent of the world. So the big discoveries and new announcements come during that time season, which is summer down there, but winter up here. The big story this year was they're detecting gravity holes in Antarctica, and that's never before been seen. A couple years ago, it was that cosmic rays were coming up out of Antarctica, as well as detecting radio waves coming up from below. And so all of that to me just sounds like we're talking about some knowledge of perhaps civilization down there, some kind of higher intelligence, and that might even be using these gravity holes as a way to transport themselves, like we would use a wormhole to move around, but perhaps into the center of the Earth. So that begs the question, is this gravity hole in Wilkes Land connected to the major holes in the ice that are known? And I point out to your audience that Antarctica is the most volcanically active continent of the world. Even though it's 99% covered in ice, you've got 14 known active volcanoes and 93 known geothermal vents. So you'd have the propensity to create these large under ice domes, and then the holes being chimneys where heat needs to escape. And some of those holes, especially the one near the South Pole, could be the key to unlocking some kind of disclosure with a high-tech civilization down there. And that's exactly what Admiral Byrd wrote about in his diary, that he flew down into the hole after being the very first aviator to fly over the South Pole. Yep. He goes back there in the beginning of a high jump, which is November 1946. And that's when he had the 3 hours of missing time, which is absolutely established in the records of high jump and his flight down there. And they thought he was gone. They thought he was dead. He crashed. It'd be very hard to recover him. But 3 hours later, he comes back and he says, we're flying back. Him and his radio man named Howie. And he describes it in his diary. Of course, I reprint several excerpts and have the cover of the book in my book because it's just so remarkable. The missing diary of Admiral Richard E. Byrd. Well, it's not missing anymore. We have it. But the subtitle is A Secret Expedition and Discovery and Journey to a Paradise Inside the Earth. A paradise. What a curious word to describe what he saw down there.
Yeah.
Because you would think the frozen continent would be the farthest thing from paradise. But as you said earlier in the show, rainforests and verdant green valleys, and Byrd himself said how surprised his radio man were to see such things. And then they thought they saw an elephant upon closer examination. He writes about it in his diary. It turns out to be a woolly mammoth. So even Ice Age era mega fauna existing down there.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Admiral, here's the thing. Admiral Byrd wasn't like a, he wasn't just a called Admiral. You know, it's not like the Colonel from Kentucky Fried Chicken, where he's just kind of giving himself a title. He was one of the best admirals that the U.S. Navy had.
Ever had. Yo,
ever.
Highly decorated. They'd throw ticker tape parades for him in New York City.
Yeah.
When he'd come back from some of his Antarctic expeditions. Very highly esteemed military man, but also one of the greatest explorers in American history.
And what do we know of Operation High Jump? What came of that? What was the purpose for going there for High Jump to begin with?
So there's the cover story, and that was to go down to Antarctica to train our troops for cold weather activities. But they could have done that in Alaska or Greenland with much less cost and distance traveled. But they put together the High Jump expedition the very first season they could go down there after World War II concluded. And in a press conference, Byrd, which this would be his fourth expedition down there, that High Jump was military in nature. But that doesn't explain why they were going down there with 4,700 troops.
Yeah.
Who were combat ready, an aircraft carrier, even a submarine. It was an invasion force of Antarctica. So it was never fully explained why they had to go to such lengths to go down there. And it broke into three different groups. So there was the main group that Byrd stuck with, and that was pretty much parked off of the Bay of Whales at the Little America base that he helped found. And then there was a Eastern and Western group of ships that went around Antarctica in both ways and converged in New Schwabenland. And so then they're also charting, mapping, and photographing this area. Here's some passports we found of the Kriegsmarine and actual base 211 in New Berlin in New Schwabenland, passports of Germans who were heading down there. Just absolutely remarkable. I had this great research assistant that came up with so much of this incredible information that we reprint in the book, including those maps that have come out. And so the Americans knew about it. The British knew about it. The British were spying on the Germans all throughout World War II. And you remember the German code, the Enigma, got cracked by the Brits midway through World War II. And so they were listening to all the U-boat communication. They knew they're bringing in huge amounts of material and personnel. They told the Americans about that, who then launched High Jump as soon as they possibly could after the war was over for the first Antarctica summer. It was supposed to go down there for 6 months. It only lasted about 2 months. And on the way back, after being handed their ass to them, and this is the depiction on the cover, is the Battle of High Jump, that Byrd made the very curious statement of saying that in the event of a new war, we would have an enemy that could fly pole to pole at incredible speeds. And that's exactly what these Honeyboo and German engineered discs could do. But still to this day, we're not even being told there is such a craft that could fly pole to pole at incredible speeds.
Well, and, you know, we, of course, brought over right at the same time we had Operation Paperclip, which is mentioned in the book as well, which is, I mean, that's how we got Wernher von Braun. That's how we got the rocket program. That's how we eventually made it to the moon, all kinds of things. So we fully lifted that technology. It was a great effort on our part to squirrel those scientists away and to, and, you know, as it says in the book that, the SS never surrendered, and they were the ones who, they were the ones who left and started the new Reich and things like that. And once again, the idea that has infiltrated in a dark way so many other facets of society that we are fully unaware of, and truly that in that real Captain America Hydra kind of way, you know, where it's like, no, they just went full deep dark, and you'll never know that they're there. They're just in the background running everything.
Exactly. Have you heard of Stuart Swerdlow?
I have heard.
He's one of the last surviving Montauk boys.
He's
been giving interviews lately, and he says he has a friend who was born in the New Berlin base, the big settlement below the ice in Antarctica. And his friend tells Stuart that they would like to come out. They would like to say that there have been multi-generations of Germans living there, but he said, we don't know how they would handle the news of there being a Fourth Reich that has been in existence since the end of World War II.
Yeah, that's never left.
Right, because how would the world handle that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, right now we're faced with a lot of how is the world going to handle that period, Brad, from Fourth Reich to technologies from Antarctica to how are we going to handle what may come about July 8th, you know, and the announcements that may come about then? Because we already know that President Trump has called for a declassification of everything that can be declassified, everything. So we'll see if that promise occurs. Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And that was really the first part of the leak was the leaking that there had been a speech written that was going to be happening July 8th. And
why July 8th and not July 4th?
Well, once again, I find it funny with the July 8th date, because that is when the official announcement happened that, like, we had shot down. That's when the RAF announcements happened from Roswell.
Yeah.
You know?
So the speech would probably tie that together.
It would be on the anniversary of that. So it'll be interesting, and it'll be interesting to be at Roswell this year, covering it like I do, and see the vibe is there just before, like it'll be happening days before this announcement, days before this supposed speech.
You got to do a live broadcast, Chris.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those, like, even I've even had people asking me, you know, like just in private messages, like, what do you think Artemis is going to find on the other side of the moon? Do you think they're going to let us know? And it's like, number one, absolutely not. They would not let us know. They would never let us know.
But maybe it's a controlled leak. that they know that they want to show something on the black side of the moon.
Yeah.
Leading up to this speech in July saying, hey, we found something.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of the people I've talked to, secret space program people and others in the military industrial complex, they say that we have this technology, like Ben Rich in the 1980s said, we already have the technology to take ET home.
That's right.
So bottled up in these black projects, we don't know how to release them. And it would take an act of God to do so.
Yeah.
So they kind of painted themselves in a corner. How do we release the information that we have this technology?
That is what I have been saying. The last congressional hearing that happened was the whistleblowers. And George Knapp was there. And he has said it for the longest time, and he said at that, you know, these contractors have done exactly what we pay them to do. They've done exactly what their job is, and laud to them, good on them. Because their job is to take these materials and keep them secret. Keep right. them squirreled away, keep them quiet, reverse engineer them, see what we can find out about them, and can they help us strategically? So good on you for doing your job. But the problem with science is science requires collaboration. And you can only keep these things locked away in secret with like 8 people a year seeing them and researching them for so long. Before, like, you're going to get diminishing returns at some point because there is no collaboration. There's no competition. We got robots to Mars because of competition, not because of keeping a program secret. We opened it up and we said, everybody compete to build us a robot for Mars. Let's see who can do it. You know, that's how we get places, is that competition. And he exactly said, I bet you right now, all these R&D programs and these manufacturers are looking for an off-ramp.
Yep.
They're looking for a way to be able to share this with another lab and bounce ideas off somebody other than their own 8 internal people and the 3 internal people that have died. You know?
If you think about a disclosure on a military-industrial scale, the first impression would be absolute awe. Wow, we've got actual technology to get us off planet and go to Mars and even beyond. But then the second question would be, well, why have you been hiding this from us for so long? And this could be the off-ramp you're talking about. This is the way they could say, well, you know, we had this technology, but we had to keep it secret. But we're telling you now because we've seen stuff on the back of the moon, or the military's just been ordered to release all their documents. And no president's even come close to that tweet that Trump made last month, ordering the military to release all the information they have. So, this is a huge, big leap forward for disclosure.
It's going to be interesting to see what comes from it, man. It truly is. And I've said for the longest time, I don't care who does it. I am politically ambivalent. There's a reason why the color of my show is purple. It's not just the crown chakra. It's where we should all be politically. We should be questioning every one of them. You know, but it's the fact of, these things have been hidden in secret programs. And believe what you want, folks, about the congressional hearings, what have you. The one thing I keep saying is the only way you stop this is with purse strings. That's the only way you stop a black program is to strangle the person in charge of it with the purse strings that fund it. So we've got to, and the only way you find that is through legal means, you know, so we will eventually have our Ollie North, you know, that was a hypothesis and a dirty conspiracy theory for years that weapons were being sold for drugs and lo and behold, somebody stood up before Congress and raised a hand and said, yes, I'm the one who's been selling missiles and drugs and been doing it in the name of the CIA. And I challenge you folks, feel free to look it up. Feel free to let me know if you find the first time that like the CIA did not lie to Congress the first time they were asked something, you know, like it's their job. If they didn't lie, I would be highly disappointed in them.
Now it's a foregone conclusion. Right?
That's it. You know, so it's one of those, this is exactly their job. much like the contractors. It's their job to obfuscate things while they research them. It's their job to find this stuff. And like the Lockheed Martin video that we play all the time about the miniaturized nuclear reactor, where the guy's standing in front of it and it's about the size of what's behind me. And he's like, hey, I 2 and 3 generation this every year. By the time I'm finished with this project, I'll need a new job. You know, that's how rapidly this is moving. We'll put it in homes and everything else, but it'll go into weapons first.
Right. and that's why they justify keeping it all bottled up.
That's right.
In the black programs.
That's right. So, you know, it's done for defense. It's done for national security. And until the day that they can bring it out and monetize it, Brad, to make that investment back, because you got to make the investment back on research and development and reverse engineering somehow. So until they can come up with the microwave or whatever is going to happen that causes that, what is the vested interest in getting it out there? What is the vested interest in letting the public know? Or is it the fact that they're letting us know because that's the only way that the new technology does get to us? That's the only way that we do make the next leap in consumer is with this technology. So there's a couple different options here that are in front of us. It's exciting.
Yeah, very much so.
Brad, I want to thank you as always for coming on the show. It's far too infrequent that we have you on, but it's always a great conversation whenever we do. Let everybody know where they can go to A, follow your work, because it is voluminous and constant. You probably do more conference appearances than anybody that I know in the industry, like at least personally know. And the shows you go to are absolutely amazing. And the books you release are always well researched and always very, very well put together. So let everyone know where they can go to keep up with your work, where they can go to follow you, all that kind of good stuff.
Thanks, Chris. And both are right on the screen there. So for my projects that I'm working on and my conference schedule, go to bradolson.com, just as it's spelled there. And I've got coming up the New Living Expo in San Rafael in the middle of April. And then I'm flying out to the New York Awakening. Then I've got Rise of the Guardians in Sedona. Then I fly out to Germany where I'm giving this talk about my research of the U-boats going under the ice. That'll be in middle of May. Then I fly back to America. I go to Contact in the Desert. And then I'm heading back to Europe in June for the Bosnian Pyramid Conference. And so really looking forward to giving some talks with some really esteemed people.
Wow.
Billy Carson has been added to the Bosnian Pyramid Conference. So he's going to be there, and he'll also be at New Living Expo. So some great people speaking there. I always bring books, and I have copies that I can sign for people at from CCC Publishing, which is where you can also get a signed copy from me of any of my books at CCC Publishing, including Secrets of Antarctica, The Untold History of the Ice Continent, which just came out at the beginning of the year.
Absolutely, man. And once again, I am about halfway through it almost, and it is absolutely great. The volume of information that is in there just in the first 100 pages is fantastic. So I cannot wait to read where it goes for the rest. I guarantee you, folks, there are zero spoilers in this episode because he is always chock full of data in his book. So thank you again, Brad. Please do hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online, everybody, heading over to cccpublishing.com to get your copy of Secrets of Antarctica, Untold History of the Ice Continent. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find all of the movies, all of the videos, all of the classes and books from our guests, including Brad Olson. That is also where you can find your link to CuriousResearch.org and your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher into the world of paranormal, UFO, UAP, cryptozoology. This is your back pocket field log to write down your data in the field as it happens to you in real time in a scientific way so that your data is ready to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you so much, as always, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.